See everybody today. We have a lot of people at family camp this weekend, and we miss them. Glad they made it through the storm okay last night. We're glad that you're here. As was mentioned before, it will be mentioned again, be sure that you're ready for our fish fry on Friday night. It's going to be an excellent opportunity for us to have the community come to us and have an opportunity to meet people and get to know people and show benevolence and love to them. Also next week, I won't be here. We are having a gospel meeting. And Jay Lockhart will be filling the pulpit, and he will be preaching this next week. So be sure not only to be here on Sunday, but also come Monday night, Tuesday night, and Wednesday night. And be sure to support that meeting, and be sure that we can have a good meeting that lets the word get out into the community. Turn in your Bibles, if you will, over to Genesis chapter 2. Genesis chapter 2 is where we'll start from in our lesson today. As you can see on our little PowerPoint, the message today is your marriage in shape? And in honor of Family Week, which started here at Benton and has gone throughout the state, each year this week is Family Week. Well, the basis of a good family, the basis of a strong family, is a good marriage. And so it's important for us to look at our marriages and look and see what it is about marriage that makes us strong, what it is about marriage that God emphasizes for us to keep. And to kind of use as illustrations, we're going to go through three different shapes and talk about how those shapes represent our marriage and how they work along with our marriage. The first shape I want us to look at is a square. Now, a square represents foundation. And the majority of us who have houses, our houses will be in some form of a square. Maybe a square, maybe a rectangle. For those who build their own houses, it may be a rhombus. It's kind of a joke. Whenever I build something, it's never square the way it should be. Everything's out of sorts. A square is something which we see when we look at strength, when we look at foundation. And whether you're looking at a building or whether you're looking at the New York skyline, you see squares are used over and over and over. We could go all the way back to the basic element and talk about how that creates squares, and that's another lesson. We represent the power of foundation and see what each point of a square represents. And as we look at each one of these points is a foundational principle of the family. Show the foundational principle must be comparable. Many people say, well, you know, and it's okay if a person feels that. It's okay if a person is made. The Bible doesn't teach that. In the very beginning, we see that God made man and made woman. So we go to Matthew 9. Jesus says, have you not heard that God made them male and female? And so as you and I, it's not correct. It is not right. Comparable. As we look there in Genesis chapter 2 and we begin there in verse 18, we see where God's man should be alone. I will make a helpmeet comparable to him. And as you and I read through that passage, he took the rib out of Adam's side, and from that rib, he created woman. And as Adam woke up, he said, whoa, man. And he was happy. He was very happy to have her. And as you and I, you have a woman, and they're put together, made perfectly in every respect for one another. When she sees how messy the bathroom is, and how messy I leave the bedroom, and I don't pick everything up, and how messy I... Women are comparable together. Josephus has an illustration which often will bring up in our... And what Josephus says is God did not make woman from man's head so that she may rule over him. Nor did he make woman from man's feet that he may tread her. But he made one body that was closest to his heart. And that shows in very clear detail what God thought about the relationship of man and woman. Yes, we'll read in the Bible, we'll get to a point here in a little bit, especially in Ephesians 5, where we see that man is the head of the house, and we see that women are to submit, and we see that men are to love. And as we get to see, it's not just about who's in charge, but it's about the reciprocal relationship that husbands and wives have together. It's about that love which is there, and that love which is so very important. And as we go to our next verse, we'll see there in chapter 2 and verse 24, the idea of cleaving. When I was at Freed Hardeman, one of my professors, his daughter was in the process of being engaged, and she was about to be married. And all I heard that whole class, every day at least once, he said, if you cleave, you got to leave. He would say that over and over. And I'm sure when he got home, he said that to his daughter all the time. If you cleave, you got to leave. Well, what was it he was trying to get across? You see in this passage, therefore shall a man leave his mother and father, and he shall be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. That verse is a very, very, very important verse to a happy marriage. What we read in that passage is that when you are married, there is no one on this earth more important to you than your spouse. Not your parents, and not your children. You see, a lot of people want to still belong to their parents and want to find out from their mother and father about every single thing that's going on and about every single one of their opinions about what's happening, and they end up neglecting their spouse because of that. And that's not God's idea. That's not a foundational principle of marriage. Other people go in the other direction, and they are all about their children. Whatever children happy, whatever it is that their children care about, they end up revolving their life around their children. And then when their children grow up and graduate, and when their children move out about the age of 30, their children move out, there's empty nest syndrome. And now they're stuck with the spouse they haven't talked to for the last 18 years. And they don't know who that spouse is, and there's not a marriage anymore because everything's been about the children. The best gift give to their child. And so you and I have always got to remember that we must cleave, that we must become one flesh. And that's more than just a physical aspect. It's also the mental aspect. It's also, hopefully, the spiritual aspect. It's also the emotional aspect. That idea of becoming one flesh, becoming one person, to live life pleasing, to live life serving, to live life helping your spouse. Well, as we go on, we see the passage which Brad read for us earlier in Matthew chapter 19. And we see not only must marriage be comparable in seeing the relationship of a husband and wife, not only must marriage be cleaving, but our marriage must be constant. You ever see sometimes a teenager who's dating somebody? And while they're dating that morning, they're in love. But then they go to first period and somebody doesn't hold a hand the way they're supposed to down the hall, so they're broken up. But by second period, they're back in love. But by fourth period, they didn't pass a note correctly. I know I'm showing my age. We don't pass notes. They didn't send a text in the correct way. It only had 20 characters and not 40 characters, if you're doing Twitter. And so they break up again. But then they go home and then they talk and they're back together. And then a little bit later, it falls apart again. And because of that, your person is happy and sad and happy and sad. Too many people have marriages that way. And that's not the way God designed marriage to be. God designed marriage to be a constant in life. You see, we have too many things in life that go well, go bad, go well, go bad. Too many things in life that change, and too many things in life that maybe in style one day and out of style one the other day, or maybe expected of us one day and may not be expected of us another day. And so therefore, God designed marriage to make it where it is a constant in our life. Over these last few weeks, in fact 2 months, we've had three families which have celebrated at least 50 years in marriage. Isn't that amazing? You think of all that time they've spent together. And of course, I'm sure they've never had a fight. Well, maybe they've had a few tusses. But they've recognized the importance of permanence in marriage. They recognize that if they were married in a church building or if they were married before a judge with witnesses, that they made a vow. They made a promise before God and everybody else. A promise that they would remain married to that person till death do them part. And that's an important promise to keep. Is it hard sometimes? You bet. Does it seem impossible? For some, yes, it does. But it's a permanence. It is a constant that we need to have in our life. Don't go one day saying, well, I love my wife, and then the next day say, I don't know if I love her, and I don't know if I'm going to keep her around. And the next day go the other way, even if you're joking. Because that needs to be a constant in life. Your children need to have that foundation. You need to have that foundation. Now, of course, in verse 9, we see it's not always the case where a person can remain married for life. But as far as it's within our power, we need to try to do what we can. The fourth constant which we see is the idea of how husbands and wives are complementary towards one another. And that's the aspect of where they have different roles to fulfill. In Ephesians 5, beginning in verse 22, he says, "Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ loved the church." He says for wives to submit to their husbands, even as the church submits to the Savior. Now, I remember back in my junior high days when I was an immature little fella, and I'm still immature, not so little, but still immature. But back then it was even worse. And I remember going through my Bible and reading that and saying, "Ha, look at that, it means I'm in charge." That's not what that passage is teaching. That passage is teaching that husbands, you have a role, you have a job, you have a responsibility in your marriage. And that responsibility is that you be a head, that you be a leader, that you be the one who is in charge. I had an uncle who fought in World War II, fought over in the Pacific side. And I've heard horrible stories about what it was like to fight in Europe, but I've heard really bad stories about what it was like to fight in the Pacific. He was in Guadalcanal, and he had a job. What they were doing was they were going through his squad, trying to flank the enemy at the time, and his job was to find snipers. Now, that's a lousy job, isn't it? But what he did is he walked across a little field, if you will, if they have many fields in Guadalcanal, a clearing, and he was shot by a sniper. And it shot him in the side, it came out the back, all this different stuff. But he'd always say, you know, boy, that sniper ended up with about six holes in him. Well, he had a responsibility. And the squad would trade off, and he'd always say about how scared he was to cross that field. But his turn came up, and when his turn came up, that's what he had to do. And yes, he was shot, but he fulfilled his responsibility. Now, I'm not saying marriage is like getting shot. That's not what I'm trying to get across. But what I'm saying is we have a responsibility to fulfill. Don't let your wife come to church alone. Don't let your wife be the only person who talks to your children about God. Don't let your wife be the one who raises your children alone. Husbands have a responsibility. Fathers have a responsibility to be the spiritual leader of the home. Husbands have a responsibility to be present, to be active, to be engaged in the home. Husbands have a responsibility to have a relationship with their wives in which they show that they love their wives and show their wives, this is who I am and this is what I believe. And you go to the other aspect, wives have a responsibility to support their husbands. There are sometimes when husbands don't lead because they never feel like they have opportunity. There are sometimes the husbands just can't get a word in. And wives need to support their husbands to help their husbands to be a leader. To help their husbands to take responsibility. To help their husbands be the men who they need to be. And we all need to examine our marriages and examine our relationship to be sure that we are comparable, that we are compatible, that we are working in a way in which God has designed us to be. Now, when you get these four C's right, when you recognize that husbands and wives are created as one, you see a foundation of marriage. When you see the fact that the relationship of husband and wife is closer than any other relationship that God has created upon this earth, stronger than the child to the parent or the parent to the child, when we see the constancy which marriage needs to have, and we see the complementary nature, you bring that across, and you're going to have a strong marriage which is very difficult to topple down. It is a very strong marriage which works in a way in which God has designed. Now our next shape is going to be the shape of a circle. And we oftentimes will bring up in a marriage or a wedding when we're marrying somebody about the importance that that circle has. It has no beginning and it has no end. And as you and I think about that idea, that shape, we see where it represents the love which exists in a marriage. Let's go ahead and look at some passages which talk about that importance of love which is there. Turn in your Bibles, if you will, to 1 John chapter 4 and verse 8. 1 John chapter 4 and verse 8. We probably have this by memory. He who does not love does not know God, for God is love. That passage, what John is trying to get across, and it's not quite the context of marriage, but we can bring it into marriage, is that love is a gift from God. Love does not come naturally. It's something you got to grow. You don't naturally love something, especially somebody. Now, you can be attracted to somebody. You can feel compassion towards somebody. You can become a friend to somebody. But when we talk about what love really is, that is not a natural act. But you learn about it from God. You see, Romans chapter 5 and verse 8, while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Christ did not die for the godly. He did not die for the righteous. He did not die for the beautiful. He did not die for those who deserved it. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. A relationship where everything has always been perfect. The exact right thing at the right time. If your spouse is always the right thing at the right time. If your spouse has always been perfect, you have not yet had the opportunity to express love. Love is expressed when the other person doesn't deserve it. When the other person deserves to be beat over the head. Love is expressed at times when it's difficult. Well, what is love? Well, we find out about that, don't we? 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Paul is sitting here talking about the church in Corinth. He's discussing what it's like to love. Remember, as we start there in chapter 12, and as we go all the way through chapter 14, we see a church which is messed up in their worship. Those who are able to do miracles are saying, hey, I can speak in tongues. I'm a whole better than you. Now the people are saying, no, I do prophecy, and that's better. That shows a little bit better stuff. And they're fighting over who's more important, and they're fighting over who's a better Christian, and they're fighting over who belongs this or who belongs that or what the rankings are. And chapter 13 begins. Look at the end of chapter 12. Now let me shift. And he starts there in verse 1. He says, though I speak with the tongue of men and of angels, if I have not love, I'm nothing. In other words, it doesn't matter how beautiful a person can preach. And it doesn't matter how eloquent a person can be if he preaches apart from love to God. It's just a clanging cymbal or a sounding brass. And he says, though I have the gift of prophecy, and though I can do all these miracles, and though I can move mountains with my faith, if it's without love, it's nothing. And what he's saying is it doesn't matter how religious a person looks. And it doesn't matter, as we might say today, how often you go to church and how often you have that Bible study at home. If you do everything without love, it doesn't profit. It doesn't do anything for God. And though I give, verse 3, though I give my body to be burned at the stake, and though I give everything I own to the poor, and though I do all these things without love, I am nothing. It doesn't matter what you give at church. It doesn't matter how much you suffer for the sake of the name. It doesn't matter how great of a Christian you are. If you don't have love, Paul says, it's not worth it. And so from verse 4 to the beginning of verse 8, he begins defining what love is. Love is patient. Love is kind. And as we go through there, we see it keeps no sufferings of wrong which has been done to it. It is pure. It looks for that which is best in other people. It hopes all things, believes all things, thinks all things, endures all things. Verse 8, love never fails. All right, we see that in the Bible. How does that translate to today? How do you show love? You show love when it's hard and when it's difficult. Love is not shown when we are in our church clothes and it's been a perfect morning and everything's going great and the children are actually behaving. Love is shown when your spouse isn't living the way they should, but you keep them anyway. Love is shown to your children when your children go off and they don't behave the way they should and they forsake and they blaspheme. In fact, you still show that love. That love goes beyond a person's actions and loves the identity. Loves that person. And that love wants what's best for others. That's the love we need to have in our marriages. Not a love of, okay, if you're nice to me, then all right, I'll keep you around. Or not a love that says, okay, well, if you still look good, and as long as you don't age, even though I'm aging, I'll keep you around. It's a love that sacrifices. It's a love that wants what's best for other people. It's a love that reflects God. When you look at the way you treat your spouse, is it a reflection of God and His love for you? We all go to the perfect illustration of service, John 13, 1 through 15. And after listening to the apostle, or listening to Jesus for 3.5 years, and seeing how Jesus was, and listening to all of Jesus' teachings, we see it didn't sink in. Because the apostles are sitting there, and while Jesus is wondering about the crucifixion, and he's about to be betrayed, and all these great things are going on, the apostles are arguing about who's the greatest. You know, where do I rank? Man, I look around this room, Peter's saying, I'm better than all of y'all, and John's saying, no, I'm better than all of y'all, and they're going back and forth. And we know what Jesus put on that towel, and he began to wash feet. The very Son of God who created the world and has the power to destroy the world or to keep the world and will judge the world is a slave. And the apostles recognize this is really, really out of place. But Jesus says, in my kingdom it's not. You've got to serve one another. He says, what you've seen me do, you must do to one another. And in that context, he's not talking about physical foot washing in church today, because that's not a need which is there. He's saying, those who are Christians are going to show love. Those who are Christians are going to be servants. If you want to be great in the kingdom, you must serve. If you want to be considered high in the kingdom, if you want to have a high place, you must take a low place here upon the earth. Don't get your name out there. Don't brag about how great you've done. Don't wait for everybody else in the church to serve you and meet your needs. But you go out and you seek ways to serve other people, to help other people, to do what God would have you to do in this world. To be the hands and the feet of Jesus. The third shape I want us to look at this morning is the shape of a triangle. Now, a triangle is the strongest shape that there is. And I have a picture that is the replacement for Egerton's Ferry. Is that correct? Okay. See, it's hard being a preacher. I have messed with Ms. Crocker all week saying, I want you to practice telling me that name. And she worked all week, and I still messed it up. But anyway, if you look at the replacement part of that bridge, it is a trellis bridge, and trellises are formed on triangles. If you look at the top of most houses, you have a triangle. A triangle, for the most part, is the most powerful, strongest of all the shapes. It can endure the majority or a greater weight requirement, if you will. Nowadays, they don't make so many bridges out of it because we've learned that the arc kind of works a little bit better because there's less fail-safe methods. But a triangle shows the greatest display of strength. If you're just going with one shape, a triangle is the shape that you want. And so in bringing that out, I wanted to use that for this lesson to show strength in our marriage. What is it that you do in marriage to show strength? Let's go ahead and look. Now, while we looked at the square, we looked at each of the points of the square. While we look at the triangle, we're going to look at the middle sections of the triangle. First of all, I want us to notice the relationship between you and God. Notice that relationship which is there. Because that relationship between you and God is going to go further than anything else to improve your marriage. When you look at the relationship between you and God, we see there in Luke chapter 14, verse 26, a paradox. Because in order to have a strong marriage, you must love God more than you love your spouse. In John 14 and verse 26, what Jesus says there is, unless you hate your spouse, yeah, that's right, unless you hate your spouse, he who loves father and mother and children and spouse and anything else more than me has no part of me. And that's what Jesus is getting across there. Now, notice what we read over in 1 Kings 11. We see the illustration of that. In 1 Kings 11, we read about a man named Solomon. And here's this man who is the wisest man that the world has ever seen, except for Jesus Christ. He's a man who wrote three books of the Old Testament, a man who went far and beyond in his time as far as knowledge. But he began to love women who did not love God. And he began to marry many foreign women. And as he married these people, as he married these foreign women, they took his heart away from God. And as far as we know, he lost what was most important. What's the point there? We have to love God most. And loving God is the best thing you can do for your marriage to make it strong. Putting God first is the most important thing that you can do to make your family be what it needs to be. Jesus said, "Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and then all these things shall be added unto you." Now let's look on the other side and look at the relationship of your spouse to God. And yes, you have a responsibility for your spouse's relationship with God. When we look over in 1 Peter chapter 3, beginning at verse 1 and going through verse 2, Peter says in that passage, talking about the relationship that wives in that day had with husbands who were not Christians, he said, you need to submit to your husbands. You need to treat them in a way so that they will be won without a word for Christ. By your chaste conduct, when they see how you live, that is the best lesson you can give to bring them to relationship with Jesus. In 1 Corinthians 7, once again, Paul is talking to Christians, and as he's talking to them, he's talking to these Christian women primarily who are married to men who are not Christians. And the church at Corinth seems to be wrestling with this in 1 Corinthians 7. Now, people have come up with this idea called the Pauline privilege, and it's the idea that if your spouse is an unbelieving spouse and your spouse abandons you, then, hey, you're good and you can go remarry. That's not what 1 Corinthians 7 teaches. You look at the beginning and it says, stay with your husband. You look at the last verse, or the last few verses, it says, stay with your husband. And throughout the context, he's saying, stay with your husband. Now, if you have more questions about that, see me after church or see me at another time. We can talk about it for a pretty good while. But going back to our lesson, we see there in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 16, Paul says in that passage, if your spouse is an unbeliever, but your spouse will remain married to you, stay with him. Because perhaps by your conduct, perhaps by your life, and by the way that you act, perhaps you can save your spouse. Look at what he's teaching for us today. I need to live in a way that will make it as easy as possible for my wife to make it to heaven. Each one of us needs to live in a way which brings our spouse closer to God. In the way I treat my wife, in the way in which you treat your husband, in the way we treat one another as a family, we need to make it as easy as we can for that person to be faithful. And we do it primarily by example, but we do it by word. We do it by our own faith that we have in God. Take responsibility for your spouse's relationship with God. And look and see in your life what you can do to make it easier for them to get to heaven. Now, of course, we look at the relationship between us and our spouses. And we see there in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7, husbands, love your wives, recognize them as the weaker vessel. And you look at the background of that idea of the weaker vessel. It's not something which is inferior as much as it's something which is more precious. My mother had a beautiful set of china. I guess she still does, unless my sister's taking it. She has a beautiful set of china. But it was so precious and so perfect, we never got to eat with it because we'd mess it up. And I remember when I was in high school, we finally talked her into being able to pull that out. But it was so funny because we had to watch out. Even if we clinked the fork on the plate while we were eating, she would stare us down. You had to treat it in a very special way because she loved this china. She loved these dishes. What Peter is saying here is treat your wife as that special chandelier. Treat your wife as that special part of your life, as the most beautiful possession that you have. And he says, and make sure things go well with her, that your prayers may not be hindered. You know, when you have trouble in a marriage, it's really hard to be right with God. It's not impossible. We see in 1 Corinthians 7, it's not impossible. But it becomes difficult. And so what we read here is Peter is saying, husbands, treat your wives well, because then it's easier to be right with God. In Matthew 5, as we look over there in 23 and 24, Jesus is saying in the Sermon on the Mount, if you have a problem with a brother, if you have a problem with somebody, go and make it right as far as you can. That's more important than you going to that temple and sacrifice. Don't have a problem with a brother if it is in your power. I think that applies to marriage. And that applies to the relationship we have in our home. And so as we close up, the question is your marriage in shape? We've looked at three basic shapes today, the shape of the square. And as we look at that shape of the square, we've seen how the way in which we treat our spouse is foundational. And if we follow those ideas, we follow those ideas of following after God, our marriages will stay strong no matter how rough it gets outside. We looked at the idea of a circle. And the idea of love, of how it never ends, and how it builds upon itself. And how the way in which we treat our spouse, and the way in which we show love to our spouse, needs to be a reflection of the love God has for you and I. The forgiveness, the compassion, and the mercy. And we've looked at the triangle, and we've recognized that the closer each point comes to one another, the closer they come to God. And so be sure that the one you love as much as in your power loves God as well. Be sure that you don't have things going on between you that can separate your relationship between you and God. And be sure to make your spouse's trip to heaven as easy and as simple as possible. At the end of each lesson, we have a time of invitation. And it's an opportunity for you and for all of us to make sure we're ready for Christ to come. As we look today at having a marriage in shape, recognize God has created us here upon this earth for a purpose of love, a purpose of service, and a purpose of glorifying God. This morning, if you need to obey the gospel, or if you need the prayers of the saints, we invite you to come forward while we stand and while we sing.